A character planted in the audience that you'd never expect to be on the payroll. And when she plays her big scene, she creates more heat than you could ever imagine. Now here's the secret. She's a stunt granny.
I just wanna listen.
As my world turns, the heart beats. Not only in my chest, but the heart in the street. So when they feel this, they feel me. But I can't feel nothing outside these Dre beats. I am from the city of evil, came from the bottom. Standing on top, I was supposed to be my coffin. What's up? Inception shows me as a dead man walking. But reflection shows this kid still got it. Let it be known I got the throne like I don't know that there's a king. Never grew up around a family cause I'm not a human being. And anyone on my level that's coming in my spot all the time. Let them
have it cause when I leave the whole world. Special edition of Stunt Granny Audio. Why is this one very special? Well, I'll tell you. We are just a few days out from the WWE Hall of Fame induction, and I'm Eric Nelson, and with me is Dusty Giebank and Dan Keister, the two resident historians of Stunt Granny, alongside myself.
Oh, God.
Thought I'd go ahead and build that up a little bit. Dusty, how are you doing today?
The Stunt Granny's in trouble if I'm an expert about anything. So,
what if you were a specialist about something?
Well, then I'd be lied to by people in charge and then end up having to quit, so.
Gotcha. Dan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Well, overall, I'm doing great. I have my problems, which we may or may not get to here. But I will say this, the site that will not be named, at least right now, has had to revamp their entire history. I don't know if you know the story behind that, Eric. I do not, but that may, who knows what that might change in the future. That I guess they're going to try and do history, but not with the previous regime.
Well, that's not too bad. I don't mind hearing that. I have seen a revamp of the look of the site to be named, and the VIP section of the site to be named. But I was not aware of the historical aspect of it changing, so we're not going to get any more. I can't even remember what the fucking guy's name is. Oh, we're not going to get any more high-end groups anymore? Is that the plan?
Apparently not. Apparently they're, I don't know who's going to be doing it, but George Shire and someone, so.
Who in hell is going to read results from AWA house shows from June to July of 1960. Tell me who.
I think that may be a real gap. I think that may be something that's really going to be missing from future coverage over there. But
yeah.
And they kind of dropped that for longer than we have. So
how,
I would say we are quite expertly.
How am I going to know how Leo Nomolini became the number three contender to the AWA championship in July of 1960?
Buy some old wrestling review magazines. You're on your own.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Break into Jim Cornette's house, let him slap me across the face and kick me out. God almighty. Well, we're going to give our attempt at history here today. We're going to talk about the inductees into the 2012 class of the WWE Hall of Fame. Six of them have been announced so far. And what we've kind of decided to do is divvy them up between the three of us and give just a little brief bio of that wrestler or that combination of wrestlers, and then we'll just talk about them and see where the conversation goes. So what do you guys think? Edge was the first one announced, so do we just want to start with Edge?
We can do that. I drew the Edge stick, and I mean, we were talking off air about how maybe they want to wait a year or two before a person, you know, retires before putting them in.
Right.
Because
that's
he...
Actually- Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
I was going to say that's an interesting topic of conversation to maybe kick this whole thing off with is,
yeah.
You know, you've got Shawn Michaels the year after he retires and Edge the year after he retires, and the inducted classes are getting so much younger. Is it a sign that they've run out of old-timers, or is it a sign of desperation to get, you know, familiar faces in, or what's the deal here?
Yeah, probably a little of A and a little of B.
Mm-hmm. Dan, what do you think?
That's why I said yes, absolutely. I mean, it's both. I think, and maybe it's my bias here, but I think they could have gotten through this year holding off with Edge.
Yep.
Although
mm-hmm.
with this Four Horsemen thing, there's some question who's going to show up for that. So that could, you can't
right.
have your headliner not show up. But There aren't a lot of headliners that are left, and I realize some of them are retiring and they can make it go for year after year, but yeah, I think they might have been wise to hold off here. I think Yokozuna is a name that they could have put, you know, as the secondary guy with the Four Horsemen, and that could have driven a Hall of Fame. But as they book, they're just kind of thinking of today. And, you know, they have a nice class this year, but you can't – well, except for Ric Flair, you can't re-induct people. I mean, maybe they'll start – you know, maybe they'll have Triple H 1 year and then DX another year, and they could do it that way. Sure. Who knows?
Yeah, that's a possibility. Yeah. I mean, if you go through old, like, house show results, you start to see some familiar names like the Black Jacks or Ivan Koloff, Bruno Sammartino, of course, and then you dig deeper and you're like, okay, is Jose Luis Rivera ever going to be inducted? Maybe they have run out of old timers, and they burn through their, like, Golden Age, 1985, Saturday Night's Main Event era, in basically 2 years when they got Tito and Greg Valentine, Sergeant Slaughter, and Hulk Hogan and everybody inducted that year. So it's like, yeah, you're scraping the bottom of the barrel for the old-timers at this point, and now you're starting to get into, like, Attitude Era. And so, yeah, I don't know. I mean, Edge makes perfect sense. Edge someday should absolutely be in the WWE Hall of Fame. I'm not going to fall on a sword and be like, it's too early, but... it's just kind of an interesting sign that, you know, maybe they're already running low on, you know, Iron Mike Sharp next year alongside Evan Bourne, who has yet to even be fired. But
there's been a real resistance to treat the Hall of Fame with guys that headlined pre-1983-84 when Vince Jr. took over the company. So, you know, they aren't going to consider too – and, you know, those guys are awfully old, I mean, or dead. So, yeah, they don't have a lot to draw from unless they want to go back. And I should probably bring up a list of who all's in the WWE Hall of Fame in front of me, because I honestly don't know exactly. Like, I was thinking, is Pedro Morales in the Hall of Fame? I don't know.
Yep, he was an early inductee. And to the WWE's credit, lately they've been branching out into the territories to try to find others, like the whole Von Erich family.
They kind of have to.
There are people who made an entire career outside of WWF, like a Nick Bockwinkel. You know, you kind of have to go that route at some point, A, to address that person's career, because they're really a legend in sport. And B, because they don't really, you know, of the Ricky Attackies and Angelo Savoldis to choose from. It's like, well, we better pick up Nick Bockwinkel first before he keels over.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a place they could go to some degree, are guys that made their names outside of WWE. But again, a lot of those guys have passed now too. So, I think it's interesting. I think a lot of the Edge induction is, you know, because of a thin pool to draw from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Indeed. Well, Dusty, you want to talk about Edge a little bit, and then we'll continue the debate?
I mean, just a brief rundown of his career. He started wrestling in the 90s. He was a Canadian wrestler under the awesome name Sexton Hardcastle. And somewhere in the mid-90s, he made a few appearances in WCW under the terrible name Damon Stryker, almost as bad of a name as Sexton Hardcastle is a good name. And if you look on YouTube, there's some Damon Stryker appearances, some stray appearances. But caught the eye of Bret Hart. I guess the Canadian connection was in full effect. And in 1997, he got a developmental deal with the WWF, was brought in 98 as part of the Brood, which I thought was a really good group. I thought that was a cool gimmick at the time. And I guess just real quick, he's gone through all the belts. He's held basically every championship. He's won a Money in the Bank. He spawned something that Kevin and Jeremy jumped on, famous for his coffee breaks during the Money in the Bank matches.
Right.
You know, they put too many guys in there, and somebody needs to take a, you know, get a hot dog or something. So
heavy on the onion.
That's right. I know, just the way you like it. But yeah, you know, like, I totally agree with what you guys were saying. Not to diminish Edge, he's had a very storied career. He's been very successful. He's been a good wrestler, a good talker. But, you know, I can see doing Shawn Michaels 1 year after he retired, but Edge 1 year after he retired, I think, is just too soon. Again, not to diminish him. He should be in there at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seems like they're really putting the pedal to the floor on this one.
Well, and I agree
but
with
an
what
excellent
Dan said
career.
About, oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with what Dan said, that really the Four Horsemen could be the headliners of the whole thing. And
yeah.
Save Edge for another year when you desperately need him.
Yokozuna
but, yeah, I mean,
in the two slot and everybody else that's in there, you know, like Mil Máscaras or whatever, and down below,
yeah.
And there's no need for Edge, you know?
Get the Midnight Express in there at some point. My gosh.
That would be nice. The
well,
only trick then is that they'd have to do business with Jim Cornette.
I know.
Yeah, you'd have to recognize his existence, and that's not acceptable.
Yeah.
but
and
they'd
yeah,
rather put Coco Beware in there.
No,
you know,
God.
Gotta get Coco in before Cornette. So
he's just as colorful. I guess the other thing with Edge is that he's a homegrown talent, and I mean they're always going to have an affinity for their homegrown talent. I mean he basically spent his entire career there, came into his own
yeah.
there. I remember back when he started his singles babyface run and thought, man, they're really trying to push him down our throats. And then he turned heel, and then in about 05 or 06 just ran with it. And so
yep.
I think they're always going to be appreciative of his contributions. And so I think that may be another reason on top of the many others that we've already mentioned, already being inducted.
I just had a general question, and I don't know the answer to it. Do you guys think it would mean more if he went in 2 or 3 years than the fact that he's going in right now?
To be honest, I don't think it would mean any more or any less.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's established that he's going to be in the Hall of Fame. He's had that Hall of Fame career. So, really, I don't think it hurts anybody to get him in there now versus 5 years from now. But, again, I think it just goes back to it's telling the pool that they have to choose from.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and he introduced the world to Zack Ryder. Zack Ryder, one of the Familia. So
yeah, there you go. One of the edgeheads, one of the hot commodities of 2011.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the mild commodities of 2012.
yeah. They're doing a great job of burying him.
Yeah.
The last audio and it was brought up that it just seemed like a no-brainer that he would be wrestling Kane at WrestleMania, and
mm-hmm.
I just agreed that I just can't believe that that's not happening. I mean, they don't want to give, and I'm not sold on the guy completely, but when you, that storyline begged for a blow-off match at WrestleMania, not, I kind of forgot about that guy that, you know, kicked my ass and broke my leg and, and whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just that's terrible. I don't know how he can recover from that. I mean, that's terrible. That's just awful.
Yeah. Instead, they're shoehorning sometimes main eventer Randy Orton against longtime veteran Kane just so the two of them can have a singles match. Christ,
I don't mean
Skinner had a singles match.
Yeah.
Zack
that's
Ryder
ridiculous.
Can't even get one of those. Yeah, it is. I mean, Edge has actually made a lot of contributions to wrestling if you think about it. He basically turned Matt Hardy's career down south and flushed it down the toilet, which is fantastic.
Super. Absolutely super.
he brought into fashion, I shouldn't even say that. Pro wrestling t-shirts were selling when they just said Hulkamania on them or when they just said Austin 316. But then after a while, it's like, Even younger high school kids kind of got embarrassed wearing pro wrestling shirts. And Edge's shirts always looked cool, and he had the rated R superstar thing, and he was kind of on the other side of the bridge between the Attitude Era, and he was a holdover from that. And then they had that awkward, like, 2002 to 2006 period where there wasn't shit going on, and they had, like, Deacon Batista and Reverend Devon and all that other hot garbage. And then along comes Edge, who's been around at the time for 8 years, and just totally is like the smarmy asshole live sex celebration, and rated R superstar thing. I mean, I feel like he was just as important in that, like, 2006, you know, holding on to keeping business afloat as anybody.
Keeping everybody from leaving, because it could have very easily been everybody leaves. They get sick of his stale, crappy product and just go watch something else. And he held on to a pretty solid chunk of people when there was nobody else doing anything, you know?
Mm-hmm. And he was able to turn himself face again because he was so damn good as a heel.
Yeah.
So to his credit for that, I mean, he kind of reinvented the pro wrestling heel, too, for the last 5 years, because wrestling heels had kind of been lacking for a while.
Real genuine heels that do heel-type things and are disgusting people. Well, you know, I don't mean that. But, yeah, I mean,
no,
right, exactly, character-wise.
Yeah.
Hanging out with Lita is despicable enough, you know?
That's what that stuff was all over his rated R shirt. I thought he just spilled on himself. No. Yeah, Edge and the rated R superstar shirts were the beginning of the jizz-covered shirt.
Yeah.
That we now see today.
Boy, TNA loves those, man. TNA just loves jizz.
I can just see Vince Russo now, like, well, not now, about 5 months ago. Let's see, if Dixie Carter were wearing this shirt, what would it look like? I would try to spell AJ Styles' name on it. Anyway, before we get too far off the beaten path, speaking of heels that everybody loved to hate, I believe the Four Horsemen were announced next, and I'm just kind of throwing this out there as a way to organize the show. But Dan, you were going to talk to us about the Four Horsemen. Let's run through their story tenure.
Yeah, absolutely. The Four Horsemen, you know, with multiple incarnations, I don't think it's necessary for our time or WWE's time to go through all of those. That could be a show in and of itself. But I do think that the Four Horsemen, up to the group that have been inducted, are worth mentioning. In summer 1985, Ric Flair was a classic world champion. This was still a time where he was going to world class and defending the world title, going to Mid-South, going to Continental, going to Missouri, defending against Harley Race, Central States, and all the various territories. And he would be a good guy or a heel, depending on who he was wrestling and where he was wrestling, as well as in the Jim Crockett promotion.
Yep.
At that time, they built their own Great American Bash 1985. Ric Flair and Nikita Koloff, they sold out the Charlotte Outdoor Baseball Coliseum. David Crockett, who had been basically physically destroyed by Nikita Koloff, was a special referee. Really excellent match, worth looking up if you haven't seen it. You know, at least to see somebody in Nikita that was extremely raw at that time, and as typically was the case, Ric Flair is probably the greatest wrestler ever, carries him to a very good match, and then is beaten up by the Russians. I'm saying all this for a reason. After that point, you hear Ric Flair in his interviews saying, I don't need Dusty Rhodes' help. We're going to fight. You know, the Koloffs, he still hates the Russians, and I'm going to wrestle against Dusty Rhodes. He's going to wrestle against Tully Blanchard, Buddy Landell. I mean, Ric Flair was defending against everybody in the World Championship or Mid-Atlantic area, whatever you want to call it, at that time, until they had a match, Ric Flair and Nikita Koloff in the Omni in Atlanta, inside a cage. Ric Flair beats Nikita Koloff again. This would have been August or September of 1985, I think. Dusty Rhodes comes out to save Ric Flair from the Koloffs, even though on the previous World Championship Wrestling TV show, Ric Flair told Dusty Rhodes, stay out of my business. People forget that when they say what a bad guy Ric Flair was with this. Dusty Rhodes saves Ric Flair from the Russians. Ole and Arn Anderson come charging into the ring. Ric Flair's supposed cousins, and were the cousins within the story. They close and lock the cage door, and then again, in one of the greatest angles you'll ever see, Ric Flair immediately starts yelling at Dusty Rhodes, who had tried to save him, They all jump him, beat him up. Ric Flair comes off the top rope, breaks his ankle, which gave Dusty more of an excuse not to move in his matches, which was good for him. And to me, that's where the Four Horsemen were born. Now,
yep.
That led up to Starrcade 85 with a bogus finish where Dusty won the title, and then they turned it returned it to Ric Flair on a Dusty finish because the Andersons had interfered.
Mm-hmm.
About that time, late 85, early 1986, Tully Blanchard joined the Four Horsemen. Arn Anderson had the famous line on World Championship Wrestling TV, not this much destruction has been around since the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. I can never say that. And J.J. Dillon, who was managing Tully Blanchard at the time, was added to the group. So you have a Four Horsemen, I would argue, from mid to late 85 on, Ric Flair, Tully Blanchard, Ole Anderson, and Arn Anderson, managed by J.J. Dillon.
Yeah.
Go ahead if there's something that needs to be jumped in here.
I don't think so. I mean, keep continuing on.
We keep building the story here. The problem is Ole Anderson said all sorts of vulgar things to Linda McMahon when Vince McMahon took over Georgia Championship Wrestling and took over his time spot on the Superstation, and Vince McMahon swore that Ole Anderson would never work for him or draw a dime for him. Ole Anderson gleefully says, "I don't want anything to do with Vince McMahon." I don't know that they would have, that Ole would have accepted had he been invited to join, although he should be inducted in the Hall of Fame with the Four Horsemen. There's no question about that. But I think WWE could be very certain that Ole Anderson would turn him down if they invited him anyway. So they got around that by ignoring this period of time in the Four Horsemen for the most part. But that was the Four Horsemen. I mean, they were the Four Horsemen, again, from late 85 to,
87.
Until 87 when Lex Luger joined the Four Horsemen.
Yeah, and the story behind that was really,
really good way of getting Ole out of the Horsemen because he was watching his kid wrestle, and basically he was going into semi-retirement. And, you know, Tully Blanchard was a great heel in saying you need to spend your time with a horseman and not watching your snot-nosed kid. Ole Anderson beats up Tully and JJ, and they quickly get Ole out of the horseman, Lex Luger into the horseman. Luger was a good horseman as well. I don't know that he needs to be inducted into the Hall of Fame with this group or not. I think he's done enough in WWE to get inducted on his own merits at some point. Yeah. If they don't want to bring up some of the things in his past, that might be what's keeping him out.
Right, yeah. Let's not induct him the same year that they induct Randy Savage or anything.
Exactly. That would be a bad idea. And people can look all that up for themselves because this is about the Horsemen and not about all those kind of unpleasant things to talk about. But so Lex Luger had a really good exit from the Horsemen as well, though. One of the funniest things you'll ever see on YouTube or TV would be the Horsemen somehow as heels being the last guys in the Bunkhouse Stampede match around right after Starrcade. Lex Luger had lost the U.S. title to Dusty Rhodes at Starrcade 87. The Horsemen were mad at him. Ric Flair had regained the world title for Monty Garvin at Starrcade 87. But they wanted J.J. Dillon, the scrawny, you know, not-in-shape manager, to have the glory of winning a Bunkhouse Stampede. So at the end, it was J.J., Lex, Tully, and Arn. And Tully and Arn jumped over the top rope, and they waited for Lex to jump over the top rope. And instead, he wanted to compete, and he threw J.J. Dillon over the top rope. And that was basically the end of Lex Luger and the Four Horsemen.
And real quick, there were some great interviews, and I will say this right now, the Ric Flair and the Four Horsemen DVD that WWE released about 4 years ago is still one of my favorites, and I pop it in all the time. It's kind of my go-to DVD. There are interviews that where Lex Luger had been getting cocky at the expense of the interest of J.J. Dillon and other horsemen. And if you watch some of those interviews where Luger's talking about how great he is and all these things he's going to do, and J.J. Dillon's kind of off to the side of the screen rolling his eyes and his head buried in his hand. It's just great to watch.
J.J.'s facial expressions in those interviews are fantastic. You're exactly right, Eric. And subtlety has been lost on a lot of wrestlers today. And
very
subtle,
much
storylines and subtle themes, but, I mean, all those interviews, I mean, everybody's fully engaged, and, you know, they're staring at the hard camera, and you can go back and watch interview after interview with Ole. Ole was a good interview, too. I mean, you've got Ric Flair and Arn and Tully that are fantastic, but Ole, there was nothing wrong with Ole, and there was really nothing wrong with JJ, so those interviews are all just, you can go one right after the other, and I've done that, too, because they're really great. Lex was not as good with words as some of those guys. Neither was Barry Windham, but the group was still phenomenal.
Yep.
So
and Barry was kind of a favorite of everybody anyway. His dad was Black Jack Mulligan, so he, you know, went back years and years and generations and everything. And so then, not to steal your thunder, but then when Lex Luger needed someone to wrestle with against the Four Horsemen, he chose Barry Windham, which then led to the foursome that we're inducting next week.
That's right. So the very first Clash of the Champions, March of – I'm probably giving more chronology than we need here, but very first Clash of the Champions, March 1988, Ric Flair and Sting wrestled a 45-minute draw. I was just watching the Ric Flair interview on YouTube leading up to that match where he talked – he basically told what was going to happen because he said, you know, remember, I'm the 60-minute man, and, boy, I mean, that's a – we may have to link that interview to this audience.
Yeah.
It's another just fantastic interview. But they had that great match, and they had a great, fantastic Midnight Express match on that card.
Yep.
But they also had the World Tag Team title switch hands, where in Florida – no, it was in Greensboro, excuse me. But in Greensboro, Lex Luger and Barry Windham beat the Horsemen for the World Tag Team titles. J.J. Dillon had been actively recruiting Barry Windham to try to join the Horsemen. Said, hey, you know, Lex Luger, he's out for himself. He'll never be there for you. They had a title defense in Florida right before the Crockett Cup where somebody posted Luger outside the ring. Barry Windham's in there wrestling both Horsemen by himself. And when Luger finally makes it up to the apron, he basically, you know, he's all limp and dead, and Windham tags him in and suplexes him, I want to say, into the ring and beats him up. He's had enough of Lex Luger. The Horsemen jump on it and win the titles. And as Barry Windham is leaving the arena with J.J. Dillon in his ear, he puts up the four-finger symbol, which was really cool. I mean, I loved it that Barry Windham joined the Four Horsemen. But sadly, that would have been about April of 1988. And in July of 1988, Tully and Arn left for World Wrestling Federation at that point, and that was basically the end of the real Four Horsemen, and I don't think we need to talk about the others today. I mean, we could spend the whole audio on that. But that's the brief history of the Horsemen, I would say, from summer of 85 to summer of 88, and the Four Horsemen that are being inducted with JJ are Tully and Arn, Rick and Barry Windham, all of which extremely deserving as that group because they were fantastic within that group. Last thing, there's a great photo that I had on my wall as a kid of all four horsemen with the belt.
That's exactly what I was going to just say. I was waiting for you to. I was waiting
Me
for
too.
The end of your bio. One of the classic pieces of photography, pro wrestling photography of all time. Flair and with the world title, Barry with the U.S. title, and Arn and Tully with the world tag team titles, and J.J. Dillon. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. I don't know what else needs to be said. You're right. I mean, there is no other group. I mean, anything after that is, you know, then you're talking like Hiro Matsuda and the Sids and the Stings and the Pillmans, which you're – and you're never going to get him to bring up Benoit, so, I mean, you might as well just stop dreaming about that.
There was a decent run there when they had the three with Sid Vicious, and but that was when Flair didn't have the title. From about middle of 1990 to the time to the middle of 91. That to me was a close enough facsimile to the Four Horsemen that I bought in.
Yeah.
They had a really good War Games match. The Tully and Arn, that wouldn't have been Tully though.
It would have been Sid.
Wyndham, Arn, Flair, and Vicious, except they had to have Larry Zbysko fill in for Arn. And Sid Vicious almost killed Brian Pillman in the War Games in Phoenix in early 1991, and that's a hell of a match.
Yeah, it really is. Definitely. So we should have a Stunt Granny YouTube channel. We should be favoriting all of these things. So maybe
I would agree with that.
There you go. That's on the to-do list for April. Yeah, cool. I don't know. I can't think of one thing to add. Dusty, how about you?
If you like Dusty Rhodes, some of those early Horsemen vignettes and stuff are like a Dusty Rhodes snuff film. So depending on your...
about right.
Yeah, depending on your allegiance to Dusty, you might not want to watch some of that stuff. But Dan, I think Dan did an excellent job. And Yeah, we don't have to mention, people like Paul Roma or anything like that. That's nothing, you know. That's not the real Horseman. This is the 80s version.
Yep, absolutely. I'll put this out here, too. Kudos to WWE. Kudos to TNA for the night that Ric Flair shows up to accept this induction. I think what it says to me is TNA has, A, enough respect for Flair, and, B, enough of a realization that they're not competition for WWE, doesn't matter if they let one of their marquee acts go to WrestleMania weekend and accept his induction. So,
do we know what the status of that is? I do not myself.
I'd never heard anything official, but anything that I've ever heard makes it sound like Flair is going to be there. I think it'd be preposterous if he wasn't. If the thing ever sees the light of day on television, the only thing you'll hear throughout their entire acceptance speech is "woo." You might as well have the guy there.
I mean, they would have to not, but they are showing a one-hour special. We were talking, there was an email about how this wasn't going to be on TV, but I think they're showing an hour review of this the night after WrestleMania before Raw.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
That would make a lot of sense considering how many of these speeches could go out of control.
Yeah. I hope they stream it live on WWE.com, but I don't know if they will or not.
That would be great if they did. That would be great. One promo that could spiral desperately out of control. Dusty, I'm excited to hear about Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson's being inducted into the celebrity wing of the WWE Hall of Fame, along with other celebrities like Drew Carey, Bob Uecker, can't think of everybody else, Pete Rose, William the Refrigerator Perry. And now we get Mike Tyson. So let's talk about Mike Tyson's contributions to WWE.
Just one of the most fascinating human beings alive, I think. I am just fascinated by this guy in every single way. He had a very rough childhood. He became one of the greatest boxers of all time. Started out at 18. Basically, as soon as you could become a professional boxer, he did. That's all he knew, basically. Was fighting. He was literally that stereotype. He was guy who fought for a living. That's what he did, you know, growing up. He fought on the streets and did not have a very favorable life. And, I mean, you know, we can go through the litany of things he did during his boxing career. The rape charges, he served prison time for raping an 18-year-old woman. He bit off another boxer's ear. just all kinds of stuff. But didn't get into wrestling until, what was it, like, I guess 97, near the end of 97. It was
No, I was going to say, here's an interesting thing that predates his most famous involvement was he was scheduled, so Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage had feuded over the world title. They had their year-long feud between WrestleMania 4 and 5. And after that, they were still counted on as main event level wrestlers, especially when it came to the TV specials like Saturday Night's Main Event or The Main Event. And at one point, the ultimate blow-off of the whole thing was supposed to happen on Main Event. I believe it was going to be February of 90, which would have been right before WrestleMania 6, Hogan Warrior.
Mm-hmm.
And And the special guest referee was supposed to be Mike Tyson. Well, just previous to that, on the eve of that event, Mike Tyson loses the boxing world title to James Buster Douglas at the Tokyo Dome in Japan, which effectively ended the guest referee stint for Mike Tyson, and they gave the spot to Buster Douglas,
right.
who fumbled his way through a promo, I think, and then went on to, like every boxer in wrestling does, deck Randy Savage, you know, at the end of the match, and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
So Tyson was supposed to play a role much, much earlier in WWF, and then, and then later down the road is when he got more involved in his more, I guess, mainstream well-known involvement.
How unfortunate is that? Douglas was totally ill-equipped for that role, and Tyson would have just nailed it, you know?
Yeah.
So that's like, I don't know what I'm trying to say, like a band replacing Jeff Beck with somebody who just learned what a guitar is, you know? he's being inducted for his involvement in the 1998 WrestleMania, and I would argue that that is the best use for a celebrity that wrestling's ever done.
Absolutely.
Just excellent use. Mm-hmm. They tied it in, they got the right kind of mainstream publicity with it. It all made sense. It was good booking. You tuned in every week to see what the hell was going to happen. I thought it was perfect. This is Russo in his heyday. And, you know, I don't want to give all the credit to Russo. I'm sure McMahon had his fingerprints all over this. And Tyson was just so naturally charismatic and, not a good talker because he loved Stone Cold. But, you know, whatever. I love Stone Cold.
I love Cold Stone, too.
Yeah.
I love mixing it in with Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, but...
yeah, damn right.
But on the other hand...
I don't know, he just had that thing, you know? Like, the thing that Hulk Hogan had, that sort of it factor thing. And they really capitalized on it, and... I don't think that their boom period would have been as big if it wasn't for Mike Tyson. He was definitely one of the pivotal players in that.
So. He drew so much mainstream attention, and I think there are two other aspects to it. One is it kind of a zeitgeist sort of thing where you've got pro wrestling becoming popular because of the counterculture NWO, and in the other company you've got D-Generation X and their juvenile antics. And so who do they bring in but the somewhat childish, you know, excited kid in a candy store, loves pro wrestling, Mike Tyson, who just, you know, finished his stint in prison after rape, you know, being found guilty on rape, and then biting off Evander Holyfield's ear. Who better to side for the time being with DX, and then still somehow managed to play that sympathetic hero when he turned on Shawn Michaels and counted his shoulders to the mat and sided with Stone Cold Steve Austin, you know, it's just, he fit that role better than anybody else could have. And the other aspect of it is I think that's something that Vince McMahon probably saw from the beginning. And really, I mean, as a promoter, as a live event promoter and a sports promoter and a promoter of personality, that's probably why he wanted to get into Mike Tyson's, you know, in bed with Tyson years earlier. Because he wanted the ability to promote this Mike Tyson character who was becoming larger than life. You know, it's perfect. It's like how he tried, you know, how Vince tried to do all the Evil Knievel stunts, you know, on closed-circuit television and whatever in the 70s. It's like he saw this cartoony character that everybody was gravitating toward. And, you know, thankfully he was able to promote Hulk Hogan. You know, couldn't quite do the Evil Knievel thing, and he couldn't quite get a hold of Tyson when he wanted to. But when he did, I mean, it you're exactly right. It the boom period wouldn't have been the boom period if it hadn't started thanks to Tyson.
Yeah,
well, and particularly for Steve Austin. I mean, the coming out of that WrestleMania, I mean, Steve Austin had been great at WrestleMania before, and they've been building up to him winning the title, but to have that done on that stage with that special referee and that scene, and give Shawn Michaels a lot of credit for the way that match went off, too, that really catapulted Austin.
Yeah, well, Austin went from best wrestler in the company to biggest star in the company. And really, that's what Vince McMahon's always after, is the biggest star.
Yes, biggest star in all of wrestling, not just the company.
Yep, no, you're exactly right.
he usurped the NWO and anything WCW was doing at that point, and was the reason they caught him in the ratings and then destroyed them.
Yeah, so. Exactly. All right. Excellent. I mean, and we can, I don't know if there's really any debate, I guess, if you're, it's WWE's Hall of Fame to do with what they want, and they added the celebrity wing in because they have such a storied history of bringing celebrities in, you know, so one of these days, if Muhammad Ali were cohesive enough, if his arm was still attached to his torso, maybe he could show up.
Maybe
a leper. Yeah. If he were coherent enough to, you know, give some sort of speech, that'd be fine and everything. But I guess what I'm saying is, of course, they're going to have a celebrity wing. So, you know, given that, then Mike Tyson makes perfect sense.
Yeah, this is the perfect use of the celebrity wing. This is an excellent induction.
Yeah, I don't know anyone that has an objection to this. I mean, if they do, they don't understand wrestling and the purpose of wrestling. So he created big business for WWE. I mean, that it seems obvious.
Yep. Exactly. Good deal. Well, let's see. I think next would have been Ron Simmons. And, Dan, are you going to talk to us about the career of Ron Simmons?
Yeah, and I'm going to focus on the earlier career of Ron Simmons. So if you guys want to jump in with more of his WWE stuff, that's fine. But I think, you know, we were talking about Edge being one of the last guys or one of the first guys to be inducted that's almost exclusively a WWE built wrestler. And we're going to see more and more of those in the future. Ron Simmons is one of the last of the territorial wrestlers. He started in late, of course, to give a little background, an All-American linebacker at Florida State University, I think three-time All-American, at least that's what Jim Ross always said on TV. And I think in that case he was not embellishing. I mean, the guy was a fantastic defensive football player, played for the USFL, Tampa Bay Bandits for a while, and I believe that was the team. He was in the USFL. And decided to try wrestling in late 86. This was just before Lex Luger left Florida championship wrestling from Florida for World Championship Wrestling or the NWA Mid-Atlantic Crockett promotion. And so I actually was looking through matches this morning and I found a six-man match with Simmons, Luger, and someone else. Against Bruiser Brody, Bad News Allen, and the Cuban Assassin. And it was kind of interesting to watch.
I hope it was either Norman Smiley or Mike Graham, but anyway.
I'd have to go back and look. I don't think it was Mike Rotundo. I mean, the third guy on the face team was not terrible, but I can't remember who it was offhand. But while Simmons is pinning Cuban Assassin, Bruiser Brody and Bad News Allen are destroying Lex Luger outside the ring because Kevin Sullivan had a big bounty on Lex Luger. So, but Simmons definitely spent, you know, close to a year in the dying days of championship wrestling from Florida before, you know, world champion, the NWA, Jim Crockett bought out them. They bought out the UWF. They promoted it separately for about 2 or 3 months, and then they brought those guys into, you know, into the main NWA, which was a bit unfortunate for Simmons because I think he could have used another year or so in Florida preparing for his big his big move. Not a lot jumps out to me about Ron Simmons' career from 1987 on until. Under a mask, he formed a tag team with Butch Reed known as Doom, initially managed by Woman. They were at the big tag team. What's that?
No, I'm just agreeing with Dusty licking his chops after you said Woman.
Oh, well, yep. Of course, yeah. But they were in the tag team, the big tag team, Starrcade 89, and they didn't win any matches. They unmasked, dropped Woman, and really an underrated team. And again, you know, we were talking to Dusty a little bit off air about the Giant Bernard, Carl Machine Gun Anderson team, or Carl Anderson, Joey Ryan team they could get in WWE. Yeah. I mean, the tag team of the NWA at this time were still a big deal. And Butch Reed, Ron Simmons, and Teddy Long made an excellent team of Doom, where they were, and this was kind of unusual for wrestling, they were African-American wrestlers who were heels, but they were not black heels, if that makes sense. I mean, they were kind of cool in the way for 1990s. They'd have those interviews where Teddy Long would talk about Soul Brother Butch and Soul Brother Ron.
But,
you know, this was not any sort of a, I mean, I guess people could reach for a racist, you know, oh, they're black guys and they're the bad guys, but that wasn't what these characters were, just kind of badass guys, and they were wrestling teams like the Steiners and the Rock and Roll Express, and they had an excellent feud with Ric Flair and Arn Anderson. They had an excellent double DQ at Halloween Havoc 1990. I was at Starrcade 1990 in person in St. Louis, where they also fought Barry Windham and Arn Anderson to kind of a double pin situation where neither team won the match, and an excellent street fight match. And of course, Ric Flair was supposed to be in that match, but he was in the main event against Sting. So they were just an outstanding team in Doom. And then once they dropped the belts, eventually they kind of all went their separate ways. I mean, Butch Reed was getting a little bit older, and Ron Simmons had a singles career. He had a very good match against Lex Luger at Halloween Havoc 91, where he challenged for the world title.
Yep.
And they brought out the old Bobby Bowden training at Florida State Video, which is kind of good for a campy watch if anyone wants to find that on YouTube. Kind of the old Dr. Death from Oklahoma. They did basically the same video, except they had Ron Simmons training at Florida State. I'm sure that was Jim Ross's
idea.
And it was
good to see Bobby Bowden, too. He's my all-time favorite college coach. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he really put over Ron Simmons, as he should. I mean, Ron Simmons has been a great player for him, but he didn't disparage wrestling or anything like that. I mean, it was a good training video. I mean, I like it when they did those kind of things. And he had a very good match, 2-out-of-3-fall match with Lex Luger, Havoc 91. Was kind of fading in and out of the main event or upper mid card when Bill Watts took over WCW in 1992. They'd been going with Sting and Vader. Sting had not really drawn that great as a world champion. Vader was a badass, great world champion. And then out of nowhere, one night in Baltimore, Maryland, August 2nd, 1992, Jake Roberts showed up in WCW, attacked Sting, and put him out of action. And they had a random draw for the top contenders, who was going to get to wrestle Vader for the world title. And they drew Ron Simmons' name. And Ron Simmons beat Vader for the world title in August of 1992. And I thought was an outstanding card. Like, the booking of that was fantastic. The crowd pop was unbelievable. And I thought Ron Simmons, you know, started out as a really strong babyface world champion. His interviews were never his greatest attribute. But, you know, a real kind of genuinely tough guy. And you could tell that, you know, he was somebody that made sense as an athlete type
as
world
athlete,
champion.
Yep, exactly.
Lost the world title to Vader at the end of 1992. Wrestled Dr. Death, Steve Williams at Starrcade 92 to some sort of no contest. That was even a replacement. I forget who he was supposed to wrestle. That Starrcade 92 was really a cluster. They didn't book it very well.
No, it wasn't nobody.
But and then, you know, that to me is the hot. That's to me why Ron Simmons is in the Hall of Fame. He had some good work at ECW against Shane Douglas around November to Remember 95, which I thought people kind of forget. He had some decent interviews and tag work with Too Cold Scorpio, and then you know, had mid card roles in WWE in a good tag team with JBL, but. Maybe that's what more people think. I'm sure WWE is going to focus on him saying damn and being part of the disciples and all that. But, you know, I look at Ron Simmons' career more as previous to that as being what I enjoyed as a fan. And I thought his work as Doom, his work as world champion, and his work in ECW were all quite strong, and he's very deserving.
Dusty, I always associate Ron Simmons with a time period in WCW that you absolutely adore. Talk to us a little bit about that and just about Ron Simmons in general and how you think he's deserving of this.
Well, absolutely deserving. But, yeah, I love 91, 92 WCW, where they really started getting behind him as a singles wrestler. Butch Reed was in and out at that point, I guess, at the end of his career. I don't know what he did after that besides a few appearances, nothing important. But, yeah, getting behind Ron Simmons and, you know, that racist Bill Watts, that motherfucker pushing the black guy to the world title. I don't know how dare he, but excellent athlete and a legitimate athlete, and that's the kind of people that wrestling should push, and unbelievable for him to beat Vader when not a lot of people were believable against Vader. I guess like Sting and Simmons were the only two I would have really bought beating him at that point because he was just a monster. Yeah, that work. And the stuff before that, sure, absolutely. All of it put together is enough for a Hall of Fame career. WWF didn't really respect him in the same way. Mostly just a mid-carder. Yeah, the Nation of Domination was something, but that was more of a vehicle for The Rock than anything, or became that way. So, yeah, late 80s and early 90s, I loved the shit out of him. And I've watched...
I was just going to say, it is worth mentioning that in his role to kind of get pushed out of the Nation of Domination and have Rock kind of come into his own, I thought he did a nice job with that. I overlooked that part of it. I mean, they brought him in with that ridiculous blue outfit, Farouk, whatever. And
Farouk Assad, yeah.
Yeah, that was just some bad WWF booking. But when he was in the Nation of Domination and the Rock kind of came into his own, I thought he did good work there. But, I think more of the focus, I don't want to take the focus off of the earlier part of his career.
You talk about Mike Tyson creating a star with Austin, and he kind of did the same with The Rock late in his career. So credit there as well.
Yep, and the other nice thing he did is he was able to slide out of that. He was, he's established wrestler, former world champion, but he's not one to believe his own hype, so he was happy to, help create that star in The Rock. And as he transitioned out of that, and Dan, you just used the word role, I mean, he became a role player, but the great thing is that he thrived in the roles that he was in. Some of my favorite, I don't know if they're memories, but I remember, but some of my favorite times watching WWE or WWF in 98, 99 were watching the Acolytes and the APA and just dominating and destroying everybody. I thought it was a great tag team. I mean, yeah, it was in the later years of his career, and I completely enjoyed his run in 91 and 92 in WCW. I just caught the tail end of the Doom thing. I saw Butch Reed turn on him and, immediately became a Ron Simmons fan. But I thought his work as in the APA, again, he was playing a role. He was just kind of, in a slot. But he absolutely made the most of it. He was entertaining, drinking beer, smoking cigars. And that's how the damn thing came from. And the thing is, he was a great athlete, and he's a member of the College Football Hall of Fame. He's a member of the Orange Bowl Hall of Fame. He's had his jersey retired at Florida State. And his promos weren't the best part of his career back in 91, 92, but there was something where he just came into his own in 98, and you're like, it's like Uncle Ron. You would have had him over at a family reunion. That's just who he was.
Well, and I'll say this for him in that stage of his career. I mean, if you look up and down the WWE roster today or at any point, here are all these guys developmental. I mean, they're talking up guys like Chris Hero and Claudio Castagnoli and Tyler Black, and it's like maybe they should get a shot. And we could all pick guys. We'd say, you know what, that guy's dead weight, that guy's dead weight, that guy's dead weight. They could get rid of these guys, and no one would really – miss him. And I never felt that way about Ron Simmons. I mean, he was entertaining in whatever role he had, where you kind of liked having him on your TV show. You never really got sick of seeing him. So there's a lot to be said for that.
Yep. I will say this, that two of my good buddies in the Iowa pro wrestling scene around here, TS Aggressor and Mr. Destiny, both got their asses kicked by Farouk and Bradshaw at a bar in Kansas City for a segment on Monday Night Raw. So I'll always be one degree of separation away from Farouk, from Ron Simmons. Cool. I think, yeah, that pretty much sums up Ron Simmons, 100% deserving. Glad to see him make his way in. I believe Mil Máscaras was announced next, so I'm going to go ahead and run down. I drew the short stick. I'm not going to lie. I drew it myself. I figured I'm gonna go ahead and build up my team of foreign fanatics here for the Stunt Granny Hall of Fame audio. But I'll make it fairly quick. Born in 1942, which surprises me. There's something about him that seems so timeless that I figure he's been around since 1900, or that he wrestled Abraham Lincoln. I don't know, but that makes him 70 years old this year when his birthday comes around. He, professional wrestler and actor, kind of followed in the footsteps of El Santo, famous luchador in Mexico, and famous actor also is in 50-some-plus movies. Mil Máscaras probably in about a dozen movies himself. Kind of a superhero in Mexico. Very, very well-known baby face. Started wrestling when he was 23, primarily wrestled in Mexico, made his way up to Los Angeles in the late 60s, and that's when he started wrestling the Americans. Got into feuds with like Ernie Ladd, John Tolis, kind of bounced back and forth between the West Coast and Mexico, making a name for himself over there. And really, I think a lot of people probably have heard, at least heard of, time that he spent in the Worldwide Wrestling Federation in the 70s. Had a few matches with superstar Billy Graham. But really the big thing that I remember hearing about his time in the WWWF was, of course, their home base being Madison Square Garden. Madison Square Garden had a ban on masked wrestlers. But Mil Máscaras was such a superstar and potentially such a draw that Madison Square Garden agreed to raise the ban on masked wrestlers for Mil Máscaras. So he was able to wrestle with his mask on in a match against, I believe it was the Destroyer, if I remember right, but they made the Destroyer take his mask off for the match. So I thought that was kind of an interesting little tidbit of information. Really, he's got a few things that we'll recognize him for. It was the spoiler. Yep, there it was. It was the spoiler. So probably Don Jardine, who, context sake, he trained The Undertaker, et cetera, et cetera. Kind of interesting that he was regarded enough as a draw and that the mask was part of his character. He's always been very protective of his mask and protective of his identity. So as opposed to, actually quite a few masked wrestlers, like even Mr. Wrestling or Mr. Wrestling 2, who you'd occasionally see lift up the mask with a wink and a nod as he flew out of sight. We've really never seen Mil Máscaras' face as far as we know. Again, Mexican legend, so there's not really a lot of detail to get into as far as the career in Mexico, other than to know he was a top babyface for, 40 years until he finally retired. Other American fans might also know him for a match that he had against Cactus Jack at a Clash of the Champions in 1991, I believe, possibly 1992. But, of course, the story there, 1990. Clash of the Champions.
I think it was 1990. I think it was the night the I believe it was the night the Horseman kicked Sting out down in Texas, in Corpus Christi.
That sounds right to me, yep. So 1990, and of course we all have heard Mick Foley's side of the story in his book Have a Nice Day, where he called out Mil Máscaras for not wanting to sell properly. Chris Jericho, in his first book, wrote that was putting it mildly, that he was basically an asshole and wouldn't sell for anybody. To the point where I remember this story coming out in 97. Mil Máscaras was an entrant in the Royal Rumble that was held down in San Antonio. And as if hometown boy Shawn Michaels regaining his title from Sid wasn't enough of a draw for the Alamo Dome, which kind of wasn't.
Right?
To their credit, it drew 62,000 people in a 72,000-seat dome. But they decided to bring in some of the AAA and some other Mexican wrestlers.
And I believe they discounted tickets pretty heavily for that, too. I mean, this was a period of time where they were – this was just before where they could start selling out big arenas. So that was a big deal. How many are they going to draw to the Dome? I mean, that was a big deal at the time.
Yeah, well, they needed that. They needed the visual shot in the arm. But you're right. I'm pretty sure it was either papered or heavily discounted. That was also 3 months before the dismal Monday Night Raw that drew the 1.7 rating that, almost had – Titan Sports in the toilet. Mil Máscaras in the 1997 Royal Rumble comes off the top rope to the floor with a flying body press on Pieros and eliminates himself. And I remember the rumor going around at the time was he eliminated himself because he's such an asshole that he didn't want anyone throwing him over the top rope.
Yep.
I think that summarizes what a lot of Americans know about Mil Máscaras' career, other than the fact
he's 55 at the time. Maybe he didn't trust people to throw him over the top rope. I don't know.
Yeah, so instead he decided to dive off himself because that worked so much better for people. Like Johnny the Bull Stamboli separating his urethra from his penis by delivering a move from the top rope to the floor. But anyway, that, I guess, is essentially the wrestling career of the now 70-year-old Mil Máscaras. Has won, you know, numerous international championships, made himself a career in film. Now he's a member of the WWE Hall of Fame. And quite frankly, I think it's another case of they're starting to run out of people to induct, so they're going to the territories and internationally. Not to say that he's not a legend and didn't draw millions of pesos for 40 years, but, you know, he's still
Mil Máscaras. The previous version of Vince McMahon would never recognize that.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Let me add a couple things, Eric, if it's okay. Because when I was growing up, you know, I took the After magazines, and from about 84 to about 90, I guess, I kind of kept a subscription or bought as many of them as I could. Mil Máscaras was a big deal in those magazines. You thought he was one of the top 10 stars in wrestling for sure if you followed those magazines. They'd always ask, you know, what about Mil Máscaras' mask and who's he going to wrestle? I mean, you know how they could just kind of hype things with no real story.
Mm-hmm.
And they did quite a bit of that. So from my perspective, just, you know, as a kid watching, I thought he was kind of a big deal. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of fans might have thought that. I know he wrestled. I heard Bruce Mitchell talking about him wrestling for Joe Blanchard in San Antonio. I remember him wrestling. He seemed to always be wrestling Sweet Brown Sugar, Skip Young, in World Class about the time I started watching World Class. So he wrestled for Fritz Von Erich some in Texas, and he spent some time there. But, he typically, when he went in for a big show, he would win, and he didn't do a lot of jobs, and you know, he protected himself. But
he was an attraction. I mean, he was so unique in that he was, at the time, a high-flying, exciting Mexican wrestler with a colorful mask and a colorful personality. He was like the smaller masked Mexican version of an Andre the Giant, who would, you know, he had his home base, but then he would get promoters to book him for a few weeks of shows, and he would go on tour, and he would end up on local TV. He was a hell of a self-marketer. So,
yeah, he protected. I mean, that's what I was trying to get at. I mean, I thought he was a big deal, not knowing, and maybe I should have, but, you know, this would have been 30 years ago, but I remember thinking, wow, this guy's a big deal just reading those magazines. So that's the only thing I would add. And I would probably say I don't remember that. I shouldn't bring this up, but Mr. Wrestling, too, I think was like Mil Máscaras in that you did not see his mask off very often. There were always those guys, the Yellow Dogs and the different types of mask guys that would do that. But wrestling too, I mean, he's a guy that should probably, if when we're at this level of Hall of Fame guys, and I want to make sure I haven't missed it, but I don't think he's in there. He's a guy that belongs. I mean, they put Bullet Bob in last year, and from that part of the country, I would say that Johnny Walker
was big. Yeah, just as big.
Yeah, he was a huge deal on Georgia Championship Wrestling. That's even a different era. That was national wrestling before WWF, so maybe they don't want to go to those guys. I don't know. I mean, you just never can figure out Vince's ego, but that's that. So
he's more erratic than ever.
apparently, yeah.
Yeah. Another thing worth mentioning too, Mil Máscaras is actually the uncle of current WWE superstar Alberto Del Rio. So that makes a lot of sense there. That connection makes sense for Máscaras to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. Dusty, any other thoughts on Mil, on Thousand?
I don't know. There's something to be said about protecting yourself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's that whole Hulk Hogan, you know, look out for yourself before anyone else thing. I mean, it obviously worked for him, and he wouldn't have had the career he had if he didn't do that, so...
Yep.
I don't know, you can like him or hate him, but he'd probably do the same thing if you were in his shoes. So.
Yeah, if I were in his tall boots and sucked in gut, I would do the same thing.
That's right, that's right.
He could suck in the gut, that's right.
Yeah, so there you go. Make sure to go out and rent Las Vampiras, the Vampire Girls, co-starring John Carradine and Mil Máscaras today at your local Blockbuster Video.
Not Blockbuster, they're all fucking out.
Oh, sorry, your local Family Video.
There you go.
The last announced Hall of Fame inductee, and I think it's interesting, they usually, in the last few years, it seems like they've inducted 7 people, and this year they've got 6 announced, 6 acts or whatever you want to call them. But the 6th one on the list here is Yokozuna. You know, this is kind of their token deceased wrestler, but that's not to say that he's not deserving. Kind of interesting to look back at Yokozuna's career. Of Samoan descent, he's a nephew of Afa and Sika, the Wild Samoans. He got into pro wrestling in 1984, wrestled in Japan, but still wrestled as a Samoan. Spent a little bit of time in Mexico, too, so he was actually fairly internationally traveled before he landed in the AWA, took on the name Coquina Maximus. The thing that a lot of people are going to remember about Yokozuna is that he was billed, when he came to WWF in 1992, he was billed at 505 pounds, and he just got bigger and bigger and increasingly bigger to the point where I think he was billed at over 600 pounds. The last weight I distinctly remember was like 589 pounds. So, I mean, large man who just continued to grow and grow and grow to the point where he just couldn't grow anymore. But Coquina Maximus, the Samoan wrestler in the AWA, used the Samoan drop as his finisher, which you can imagine was about as devastating as could be out of a 450-pound guy. Caught the eye of Vince McMahon, who at the time decided he needed a new heel character, especially during this transition in time where, you know, he's getting away from the wrestlers who look like they're bulked up on steroids because of the steroid scandal. But, of course, it's Vince McMahon, and he's still in love with the giant-type wrestlers like the Andre the Giants and Giant Gonzalez and these huge, huge cartoon-looking characters. So his idea was he's got a guy who could pass for Japanese. And he actually, when Yokozuna debuted in the WWF as a sumo grand champion with Mr. Fuji as his manager, his first few matches he was billed as being from Polynesia or Samoa. And then finally they decided, screw it, let's just say he's from Japan. So here's Afa and Sika's Samoan nephew wrestling as a Japanese sumo wrestler at a weight of 505 pounds. And immediately jumps up the ladder in that spot as the top heel, beating such luminaries as Virgil.
You guys better watch out for that Yakuzuma guy.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, my God, Yakuzuma. And won the 1993 Royal Rumble. Last person he eliminated was Macho Man Randy Savage, which was kind of that attempt to give him legitimacy as a top heel, because the last guy he threw out was a former 2-time WWF champion. Went on to WrestleMania 9, pretty universally panned as one of the 2 worst WrestleManias of all time by people who aren't named Eric and Dusty, and beat Bret Hitman Hart for the WWF Championship, his first title in the WWF, and had a 9-month reign as a heel WWF champion at a time when heel champions did not last that long, and WWF always had a history of, you know, a 9-day title reign with Stan Stasiak or a 3-week title reign with the Iron Sheik. Well, here you've got Yokozuna, who is really a great athlete, and they always talk about how fast he was and how good his timing was, and he was flexible. And you can see that when he wrestled. Here's a guy who's 6'4 and 500 pounds who's able to throw a super kick in somebody's face or, you know, come off the second rope, granted with a little bit of assist by holding onto the top rope. But, you know, as agile as a 500-pound guy could be, you know, and also given the time, you know, 1993 was not exactly a banner year for WWF, but he was the flag bearer and the WWF champion at the time. Main evented the next year's WrestleMania 10, defended the world title twice, once against Lex Luger and once losing to Bret Hart. And then, I mean, his weight got so out of control that come November of 96, Vince McMahon said, "You've either got to lose weight or I've got to fire you." And it got to the point where he failed a physical in New York State and essentially, once you fail a physical in New York State, you don't get licensed anywhere else. So everyone was like, well, you can't wrestle here. So he was released by WWF, kind of bounced around the independents a little bit, showed up on the godforsaken Heroes of Wrestling pay-per-view in October of 99, where an overweight Yokozuna and a drunk Jake the Snake Roberts, I think, lost to the heels King Kong Bundy and Jim the Anvil Neidhart, that's right. And then the last you hear of Yokozuna was he died in his hotel room in Liverpool, England, at the age of, it depends on who you believe, either 34 or 38 years old. But, you know, he was, again, fairly well-traveled in his early career, but you didn't really hear much about him until, and, you know, for whatever reason that was, there was no internet, so you couldn't really, you know, you didn't hear about this 500-pound, you know, athletic wrestler or anything like that. You didn't really hear much about him until he showed up in the WWF and became kind of a memorable character as Yokozuna in really kind of a downtime in the company, too. But I guess that's Yokozuna in a large nutshell. Dusty, what do you think?
I'm looking here. There's not a hell of a lot of video of Kokina Maximus.
No.
And I don't know. It's just, it was easier to keep secrets in wrestling in the late 80s and early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
He just sort of came out of nowhere, and all of a sudden he was Yokozuna, you know? If you weren't watching AWA, you would have no idea who he was. So,
which is good for him because he didn't have all the baggage and preconceptions coming into it. He could just show up as Yokozuna, and you're like, holy shit, where'd this 500-pound guy come from?
You know, he was one of the better reasons to watch that AWA stuff, though, when he was there. I mean, and I think they did a lot of squash matches there, so I don't think it, like, hurt him his time in the AWA. I don't remember him losing a lot of matches while he was there. I mean, he was with Sheik Edna on LKC, and it was bad TV, but, you know, I don't think it – yeah, I mean, I remember seeing him and saying, well, that's that Kokina Maximus guy, but I was watching the AWA before that. But
If you weren't already drawn in by DJ Peterson and the Trooper and the waning years of the Destruction Crew, and who the hell else was around back then? Some, you know.
If you want, I can keep going. Texas Hangman, Jake the Milkman Milligan.
The Thanksgiving Turkey Challenge or whatever it was. Then there's a good possibility that Yokozuna wasn't on your radar then.
Yeah, that wasn't drawing huge ratings.
As far as a Hall of Fame level career, though, Dan, what do you think? I mean, he was within the WWF bubble. I mean, they threw him into the world title mix right away, and he proved to be, you know, a decent WWF champion. He didn't draw a ton of money or anything, but he, you know, it made sense for him to hold the belt. Had the tag team belt at the time where that really didn't mean anything. Had a really, you know, non-memorable babyface run for the last year of his career, but. Not to diminish anything about his career, but I guess what do you think overall?
Yeah, I mean, as you said, he didn't burn as long as some other guys, but he burned pretty brightly. Should have gotten Lex Luger over. It wasn't his fault. That deal where Lex Luger slammed him was one of the better things WWF did on the Statue of Liberty, whatever it was, back in, what was that, 94, I guess.
The intrepid Luger.
A very good champion. I mean, he was obviously very credible and good wrestler, and I was kind of surprised he wasn't already in the Hall of Fame, to be honest. I mean, but again, they don't want to put in more than one dead wrestler every year, so probably where that comes from. But absolutely deserving. I mean, I like the more athletic style of wrestling, but as you mentioned, for his size, he could move a little bit and have pretty good matches. And when he beat Hulk Hogan for the title and Hulk Hogan left, I didn't get that pay-per-view or anything, but I was glad they got rid of Hulk Hogan until Hulk Hogan showed up in WCW. So that I wasn't quite as excited about it, but Jim Cornette helped manage him for a while, which did a nice, you know, that kind of helped having a better mouthpiece than Mr. Fuji for him.
In fact, I'm going to interject here. I got my timeline a little screwy in that, the feud with Hulk Hogan helped, but again, it was during that weird downtime where
you know, people were kind of falling, they were jumping off the boat when it came to WWF. But, you know, of all things, Hogan does the job to Yokozuna via Yokozuna leg drop. And it's like, okay, I get that that's supposed to be symbolic at a time where you're wrestling in front of 6,000 people in Dayton, Ohio, and you know, probably 100,000 people on pay-per-view. But, you know, at the same time, it's like, that's, you know, for the egotistical Hulk Hogan to do that. And this is also a time where he wasn't about to put Bret Hart over for, you know, put a gun to his head. And he would have rather had you pull the trigger than have Bret Hart go over on Hulk Hogan. So he kind of went the Hogan Andre and Hogan every other giant route and said, I'll put over the big Jap brother sort of thing. So, you know, he had that going for him.
Well, it wasn't
the cleanest
finish in the world either. I mean, they had that.
The camera of the photographer exploding in Hulk Hogan's face. yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, not the
cleanest. I mean, he should have done a cleaner job than that on his way out, but there was a lot of acrimony there between him and Vince McMahon, I guess.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That was the best he was going to do, so.
You know, the one thing Yoko can hang his hat on is Hogan never got his win back.
That's right.
I was just going to say that.
Got his win back against almost everyone else, but Yoko was the one guy. He could never get him into WCW. He could never get the win back. So, God bless Yoko for that alone.
Yeah, absolutely. Poor Hulk Hogan. That's funny. Well, that's the Hall of Fame class, WWE 2012 Hall of Fame. I can't think of too much more to say about it. I'm going to wrap this up. So. Dan, is there any other final thoughts on the WWE Hall of Fame this year?
I think it's a good class. I enjoyed talking about it with you guys, and happy to be a part-time contributor over here. So yeah, happy to take part.
Happy to, of course. Yeah, I guess my two cents real quick are, I hope it ends up on TV in some form or fashion, or I'm going to buy the DVD because there are quite a few acceptance speeches that I'm excited to hear. The Four Horsemen will be good. Edges should be interesting. I'm excited to see some of the presenters. That should be cool. And, yeah, overall, it's a deserving class. Can't wait for John Morrison to get inducted next year. And
that's exactly what I was going to say.
Sorry. All right. Well, I'm going to sign off and let Dusty take this before I steal any more of his jokes.
Oh, I got a shtick. That's all I got. Well, for Dan Keister and Eric Nelson and for this Hall of Fame class and for Zack Ryder getting inducted next year, I'm Dusty Giebink, and this has been another edition of Stunt Granny Audio, and we'll try to do better next time.